for that trip. How did that? Okay, so the topic that I have been given for today is called emotional resilience. Is that your topic, Pam? Was that your idea or somebody?
Along the line.
Along the line, okay. Yeah, somebody's idea. And as often with, you know, with these topics, things that these kind of ordinary topics, somehow we have to translate it into Buddhist ideas, right? So the idea of emotional resilience, what does that actually mean in terms of Buddhist practice, in terms of the Dhamma? This is kind of one of the first things you have to think about when you think about when you are going to give a talk about these things. And of course, the idea of resilience, I think, is one of those very important concepts. This idea that you carry on, right? You don't allow yourself to be let down or suppressed or be oppressed by anybody, but you are resilient in your life. And resilience works everywhere, in family life, at work, in any kind of area where you have to do something, achieve something, you have to be resilient. So it's a very important aspect. And of course, resilience also applies to the Dhamma itself. If you want to live according to Buddhist principles, if you want to live according to Dhamma, it is so important that you have that resilience and perseverance, that you carry on, because the ideas of compassion and kindness and all these basic principles on the Buddhist path, they really only work if you are really committed, if you understand what you're doing, and if you persevere. There's always going to be obstacles, right? Life is really good at throwing your curveballs, right, and saying, okay, putting kind of little speed bumps in the road just to give you a test, that sort of stuff. Life always does this, and in those cases you have to be resilient, you have to carry on. And the idea of emotional resilience is, again, is this thing that we're trying to go through life in an even way, not be too carried away by the ups of life and be completely overblown by the, wow, now I understand the purpose of life, right? Sometimes it's like that, things are going very well, think, wow, I've got it, I understand it. And then suddenly it starts going down again, precisely because you're attached to and you grasp onto the ups in life. Then when you have the downs, the downs come more quickly sometimes because of that. So life is a bit like a roller coaster. So the emotional resilience is the ability to carry on, not to be too blown around by the ups and downs of life, but having that even, steady mind, and mind that can see fairly clearly, so you can make wise decisions in life, and you can carry on, and you can become a blessing for yourself, and a blessing for the people around you. What a wonderful thing that is when we can do that. So what are some of the things that allow us this kind of emotional resilience? What are the things that we can focus on to help that actually happen in our life? And one of the things that has always stood out for me, I think, is the importance of having some kind of guidance in life, a place we can go for wisdom, a place we can go for understanding, when we feel that things aren't going right, or we're having difficulties, or even when things are going well, a place where we can go and ask questions and say, what do we do now? Where do we go from here? Right? And that is what we call in Buddhism like a refuge. Right? It's some kind of wisdom teaching where we can actually find the answers to the questions in life. And it's so important, I think, in our life to have that, to have this place where we can go, a place that we respect, a place that we defer to, a place where we have a sense of reverence to. And it's actually a very poor life. You have a very poor quality of life if you haven't got anything like that in your life. It is so enriching, it is so enabling, and it's so empowering to actually have something that we respect and something we revere, somewhere we can go, something we can see as, in a sense, higher than ourselves, that can actually give us advice and guidance in this world. I think it's so important. And the Buddha actually says this in the suttas. The suttas is the discourses of the Buddha, right? He says in the suttas that someone who doesn't have this thing they can respect and defer to and have a certain reverence towards, they live in suffering. Right? You live in suffering if all you have in the world is your materialistic outlook. If all you have is your cars and your relationships and a big house and a good job and a nice career, but you haven't got anything higher. You are like the highest in your life, right? The kind of you have a big ego, well, I am the highest kind of thing. That actually, because if you are the highest and you know how many problems you have, well, then you're in serious trouble, right? There's nowhere to look. There's nowhere to look for anything more than what you are. But you know that you need some guidance in your life. You all do that. So for that reason, it is actually a wonderful thing to be able to have a place where you can go, no matter how smart you are, no matter how clever you are, no matter how successful you are in worldly terms. Basically, we all need that spiritual wisdom to guide us in life. And that, of course, is where the Buddhist teachings come in. And one of the remarkable things also that I remember from the suttas is where the Buddha, after his awakening experience, right? The Buddha, after his awakening, this is like the, from a Buddhist point of view, the highest spiritual achievement that anyone, anywhere, at any time has attained, right? Here is this spiritual genius who has just broken through to the highest possible thing that anyone can ever break through to. And what does he think? What is one of the first things that he thinks after this? He thinks, what is it that I can revere and respect in this world? And it's kind of astonishing, isn't it? Here is somebody who has attained the end of all suffering and the highest happiness. And one of the first things he thinks to himself is, what is it that I can respect and revere? Why does he think that? Well, because he says that someone who doesn't have something to respect and revere in their life, they dwell in suffering. But this is the Buddha talking, and this is what makes it so powerful. The Buddha is saying, I too want to respect something. So even for me, it would not be nice not to have something I can look up to and something I can perhaps bow down to even, right? So what does the Buddha think? Well, the Buddha thinks, well, actually, I have attained the highest kind of happiness. There is no one in the world who knows more about me in terms of awakening, in terms of understanding the psychology of human beings, etc. So I can't really bow down to another human being. There's no other human being that I see, or any god or anybody else, who is higher than me in this respect. So what shall I bow down to? And the Buddha says, the thing that I shall respect in my life and revere in my life is precisely this Dhamma that I have awoken to. This teaching, this truth, this reality, this Nibbana, the final extinguishment of all negative character traits, right? This is what I would respect and revere in my life. So if you are Buddhists and you have faith in the Buddha's teachings, you have something very useful, right? Something very powerful to lift you up and to make you feel, yay, right? I have something in my life I can respect and revere, a place I can go for wisdom and understanding when I need that. And what a wonderful thing it is to have that in your life. So this is the first thing. And if you are not yet a Buddhist, that's fine. You don't have, there's no, everybody in the school Buddhist? No, not everybody Buddhist. Okay, great. So it's run on Buddhist principles, basically. Yes. But nobody's force converted, yeah. Right? What? You are an atheist? No, okay, you have to become a, yeah. I think that's great. That's the way it should be, because people need to come to their own conclusions about these things. But keep in mind that it is very useful to have something in your life that gives you that sense of uplift, something grander, right? Something to move towards, something powerful and inspiring. It's so important. This is what happened to me, because I was not born as a Buddhist, right? People often ask me, how come you're a Buddhist? It's a good question. I don't really know how a Buddhist, it's very hard to answer, actually. It's very one of those weird questions. I grew up in Norway, right? And Norway is, Australia is quite close to many Buddhist countries, in a sense, it's more natural that we have Buddhism. Here in Norway, when I grew up, there's no Buddhism. I didn't know any Buddhists. My parents weren't Buddhist. I had a kind of natural attraction to go to Asia. So I traveled to Asia in my early 20s the first time. I read my first books about Buddhism. And it's kind of weird when you do that. It's almost as if something that is dormant inside of you gets awakened when you read something. Something almost as if it is familiar from somewhere in the past, right? Later on, when I got back to, while I was a student, I got back to Norway, and I tried some meditation practice. And wow, that also really worked nicely, right? Well, this is really powerful. This is wonderful stuff. It's a different kind of happiness that we get in the ordinary world. And again, it was something that showed me that there's something very beautiful going on here. But in the end, what I really think actually made me inclined towards Buddhism and made me a Buddhist eventually, was, I think, quite clearly because I was a Buddhist in a past life. I can't really explain why it is that I had an inclination to travel to Asia, why I had an inclination to understand the Buddhist teachings, to meditate and all of these kind of things. I can't explain it unless I was a Buddhist in a past life. There's nothing in my environment, in my situation around me, that actually should have made me into a Buddhist. It's kind of weird, right? There isn't really any way of explaining these things. So. And one of the things, maybe I should mention this right now, this might be a bit random, but it's nice with a bit of random stuff, right? I like a bit of randomness. So, one of the great things about becoming a Buddhist monk is also the effect you have on the people around you. You often have a very powerful effect on the people around you. And of course, the people that are closest to you, those are the people you have the most effect on. So I remember when I first became a Buddhist monk, my parents were aghast. They were saying, "What? Our upbringing has failed, right?" This was one of the things I was told. Upbringing has failed? What are you talking about? Upbringing has failed. Anyway, so I just said, okay, sometimes in life you have to be really stubborn, right? Just said, I believe in this, I'm going to do this. So I was stubborn and I decided to become a Buddhist monk. And what is astonishing is the kind of transformation in the people around you that happens as a consequence of you doing what is right. But the first thing I realized, there's no point in me going telling my parents how great Buddhism is, right? So shut up, don't say anything about Buddhism like that. It's all in the how you live, right? If you live well and you actually do, you walk the talk, as they say, right? Actually, you don't talk at all, you just do the walking, no talking, you just walk. If you do the walking and they see that you are changing, that you are happy, that you are doing well, you're no longer arguing with them, right? That's a major thing for parents. You're not arguing. When your parents say, "Would you like to do, you know, help with the vacuuming?" You say, "Yes, ma'am," and you do the vacuuming, right? And your attitude changes. And with that, something remarkable happened. For my parents being very kind of anti-Buddhism, anti-me becoming a monk, it gradually changed. Until one day, they too were Buddhists. And when I go back now to visit my parents, wherever it is, they ask me, "Can we do some meditation together? Can we talk a little bit about the Buddhist teachings? We are now reading this book of Buddhism. Is that a good book to read, right?" And that is kind of very satisfying when you see that, because it means that you really are having an impact. If you can change your parents, right? If you can change your own father, for goodness sake, that's supposed to be impossible. But if that can happen, then really you know that something very powerful is going on. And that is the power of these teachings. Because I think if you have an open mind, if you are reasonably intelligent and wise, you will see that there's something very powerful going on here. But just an aside in the talk, right, just to give you some kind of inspiration of the power of these things. But what really made me into a Buddhist, because this is all the background for how you become a Buddhist. But of course, the reason why eventually you become a Buddhist is because you have some sense of affinity with the Buddhist teachings, right? When you feel that these Buddhist teachings are talking to you in a very direct, in immediate way, talking to your heart, talking to something profound inside of you. And that is when I recognized that I was really a Buddhist, when that happened. Before that, it was more or less like an inclination of the mind. I was traveling around Asia, I was doing meditation because it came from somewhere deep in the past. But when one day you keep on studying these teachings, you keep on seeing what they are, and one day you think, something happens inside of you which makes you realize that there's something very important going on here, right? That is when the conviction becomes incredibly powerful. And for me, that was the day when I realized that the teachings of the Buddha, they are quite literally the answer to the question of the meaning of life itself. Right? That is very powerful. When you think that you have found the answer to the question of the meaning of life, if you really feel that, there is no turning back anymore. What else are you going to do with your life? If you found the meaning, what else are you going to do, right? It would be nuts to do anything else. And I try to avoid being nuts. Sometimes that's, you know, it's not entirely impossible. But generally speaking, when you see that, you realize the commitment to the path, the commitment to the perseverance and the practice becomes very powerful as a consequence. So, and that is one of the reasons why I have just been a Buddhist monk for over 20 years now, right? Some people think that is really weird. How can you live as a Buddhist monk for 20 years? But if you have an understanding what these Buddhist teachings are, what they actually mean, that is when that commitment and perseverance becomes very powerful. And this is part of this idea of having a refuge, right? The idea of having somewhere to go that is actually has some wisdom to impart to you, something that can give you a real boost in life. So why is it the answer to the meaning of life? And it's actually very simple here. And to see that, all you have to do is to look inside of yourself. What is life all about? And what life is all about, if you look inside of you, you see these desires, you see these cravings, you see all of these things that are always moving us around, right? We have been moved by desires all the time, from the moment you wake up and you decide what you're going to have for breakfast, what you're going to wear that day, right? Whether you're going to take the bus to work, or whether you're going to drive or whatever it is, or which newspaper you're going to read that day, right? Everything in one way or another is based on desire. So we can kind of find a degree of happiness in the world, right? Not too much suffering, not too many problems. Our long-term decisions are about that. Am I going to be a Buddhist? Should I be an atheist maybe? Should I be a Muslim, right? What is the right thing to be in life? What should I have a religion or not? What kind of education should I have? And everything is based on this idea, but we are seeking for something, happiness, satisfaction, fulfillment, completeness inside of ourselves. Everybody is looking for that, right? Have you ever heard about anyone looking for suffering in life? Right? Oh, a bit more depression would be nice. I need a bit more depression, right? Oh, that would be really great. Enough depression already. Don't need any more of that. Right? You want to move towards happiness and away from suffering, away from going downhill. So then you ask yourself, right? The world, the things of the world, the ordinary things that we do, do they ever really give that satisfaction, that sense of completeness, that sense of fulfillment that we are searching for? And look inside of yourself. You know, almost all the things that we're doing in the world, whatever we are doing, very often when you're young, you have a dream about the future. Oh, in the future, I'm going to have a career like this. I'm going to have a boyfriend or girlfriend like this. And things are going to be really nice. And then after a few years, you think, it's actually not going to be that way. It's going to be different from that, right? And you kind of adjust your expectations down a little bit. When you're young, you tend to have very high expectations. I think that's maybe one of the reasons why young people get depressed sometimes. You realize reality actually isn't that glorious as you think it is when you're younger. So, you know, we are driven towards all of these things. And things never really work out the way we think they're going to work out, right? You can see that in some of the very simple things in life, like, you know, you purchase, you get yourself a new car, and you're all so happy with this wonderful car to begin with. It doesn't take long before that car, it is completely ordinary. There's nothing about it at all. It doesn't really satisfy you anymore. It doesn't complete you anymore. It doesn't fulfill you anymore. And the problem really is that the reason why we are not satisfied, the reason why we don't feel complete, is because there is a psychological hole inside of us. There's something psychologically missing, right? And then the craving says to us, well, if this psychological lack inside of you, if you pursue this object of craving, that psychological hole will be fulfilled. It will be filled in. You won't have that hole anymore. That's what craving says. And then you pursue that craving, and actually, it doesn't really work. It doesn't fill up, because how can something that you are looking for externally, whether it is a social position, it is education, it is material things, whatever it is, how can external things in your life, how can they fill up an internal hole that you have inside of you, a psychological lack? It is, by its definition, almost impossible. Psychological problems, psychological gaps, psychological holes have to be filled in using other psychological methods, not by seeking for these things externally. And that is why we keep on running around, never finding that satisfaction that we actually want to find. Craving tells you, oh, if you run after this, you will be fulfilled, you will be happy as a consequence. Craving is a liar, right? Watch what craving says next time to you, and then see if it actually works out. And you will realize that craving is always lying to you. Craving is telling you, porkies, as they say, you're not actually going to get where you want to get with that. So we have to look in a different direction. If you want to find real contentment in life, if you want to find something which actually fulfills you psychologically, you have to look in a very different area. And that area, of course, is the area, if you like, of spiritual fulfillment. And this is part of what part and parcel what the Buddhist path is all about. So what is that? And what that is, it's very kind of simple, basically. It is just the fact that when you do an act that you might call spiritual, right, an act of kindness, an act of generosity, how do you feel when you spontaneously do an act of kindness towards somebody? How does that make you feel? And very often it gives rise to a sense of joy, right? A sense of happiness. You say something kind to somebody because you're coming from a pure place inside of you. You do an act of generosity spontaneously, not just to Buddhists, but to anyone in the world, right? And sometimes you feel a sense of joy. And if you look at that sense of joy, you will realize it is a very different type of happiness from the kind of happiness that the worldly phenomena in the world give you. The type of happiness, the kind of joy you get from doing something out of the goodness of your heart, out of the purity of your heart, it actually fulfills you. It is not conjoined with craving and desire. It doesn't look into the future, but you feel a sense of that contentment and happiness right here, right now, in the present moment. And that is why it is so powerful. It actually is filling in that sense of lack you have inside of you. It is making you feel complete and satisfied. And for the first time in your life, you can see that you are restarting to reach that happiness. You're moving towards that contentment that craving was promising you all along, but never actually delivered. Right, delivery is coming, finally. The pizza is here. Now it's being a bit naughty. It's happening, right? It's actually working. You're getting results, for goodness sake. And you can see that happening as you do this, as you actually live the life in such a spiritual way instead. What a wonderful thing that is. And then you start to understand that, and this of course is exactly what the Buddha's teaching is telling you. It's telling you to look for that happiness in the right place. And when you do, you will start to find real fulfillment in your life. It starts off with how we act. It starts off with how we speak to the people and the world around us. It starts off with how we think about things. And that then moves into meditation practice. Anyone here meditate? Anyone here? Have you tried meditating before? Yeah? It's really simple, right? You sit back, you just chill, relax, and you feel good. That's meditation. That's the very kind of the brief version, but it gives you some idea what it's about. You take that happiness with you that you gain from your ordinary spiritual practice, and you take it into meditation, right? You allow yourself to become very peaceful, very compassionate. The attitude is a very important part of your meditation practice. And as you do that, you find that even that happiness that you had before can be empowered even more through the meditation practice. You become more still, you become more blissed out, right? You become more content through that meditation practice. Until one day you find you are so content, you're so happy, there is nothing moving at all anymore. There's no craving, there's no desire, there's nothing driving you anywhere. You just want to sit here, closing your eyes, and you don't want to move from this spot forevermore for the rest of your life or for whatever else, the rest of the universe, I should probably say. Right? That is when you know that you find a sense of completion, a sense of satisfaction, where all movement, all desire, everything stops, and you're completely happy and content in the present moment. Right? Essentially, that is when you have found the answer to the meaning of life. But there's no purpose anymore, there's no movement anymore, because satisfaction in the present moment is absolute. Right? And it's incredibly beautiful, just moving towards that. Getting there even partially is just incredibly wonderful. And at this point, you really start to understand, yes, you are there. You basically found the meaning of life itself. You have come to this point of complete satisfaction. The point that craving was promising you that you would get to all along, but never actually delivered. Now you are there. And that's not even the end of the path, right? That's kind of, okay, you're getting close to the end of the path, through this path at that point. But still, there's even more beyond that. So it is the answer to the meaning of life. And what a wonderful thing it is to have found something which actually answers the question of the meaning of life. No more searching required. Now all you have to do is to apply yourself and make sure you actually move in that direction to the max of your ability. So this is the first thing, right? I should also maybe add one little thing to that, because there is one of those very famous Buddhist teachings, of course, the teaching of Kamma. And the idea, the way that Kamma is traditionally talked about, is that you do good things in this life and then you receive some kind of happiness in the future life, right? This is traditionally how karma is taught. And that, I think, is basically correct. I don't think there's anything wrong with that idea. But it's much more powerful to understand karma, how it works within the present life. Because it's actually possible to experience karma. It's the action you do now and its result right here and right now. And this is a very useful way of understanding this whole idea of the Buddhist path. So I would like you to look at that. I did mention it briefly before. But keep that in mind. When you do an act of kindness in the present moment, notice the effect on your mind, right? When you do an act which isn't kind, when you say something maybe you shouldn't have said, or maybe even just you think something that you shouldn't have thought, right? So we do that quite a lot. It's quite hard to kind of, you know, to get a mind which is always positive and always kind. But that is basically what we should try to aim for. And when you do that, notice what happens inside of you. Notice the feelings that arise with kindness and goodness. And notice the feelings that arise when you are not kind and good. And what you see is that there is an immediate effect from kindness. There's an immediate effect from not being kind, which is felt right here in the present moment. And that is, if you like, the karma in this very life. Not the karma that relates or the results that lay to the future life, but relate to this life itself. And when you start to see that, when you start to see the effect that you're having on yourself through your actions, you start to want to live a good life. If you do a bad act, right, and you feel bad about it, it's like you are your own enemy. Because like you're punishing yourself. Right? That's basically what it is. It's what the Buddha says in the suttas. It says that anyone who does something bad in life, does something with an unwholesome intention and motivation, they are acting like their own enemy. Because they are going to get the results in the future. Do you want to be your own friend? Or do you want to be your own enemy? It's your choice. Much better to be your own friend, right? It's a no-brainer. So make sure you're your own friend. And the way to be your own friend is to be kind and compassionate and feel the positive things that actually come from that kindness and compassion inside of you. And then, wow, something really happens. It's very powerful. And then you can see almost as you accumulate this, you are lifting yourself, you start to soar, your mind is feeling lighter and more beautiful, right? You're cutting off all the negative acts that are holding you down, and you feel something very powerful and beautiful happening in your life. The Buddhist path is happening all by itself. You're starting to discover really what is the meaning of life itself. So that is the first aspect, right? Having somewhere to go, somewhere that you feel that you can respect and revere in this life, something grander than yourself. If we are the pinnacle of, you know, of the world, then there's a certain ground for despair there, right? Because we aren't always that great. What else? The other thing that I just wanted to mention briefly, that is very useful for emotional resilience, is to remember some of those basic Buddhist teachings that are really so obvious. And they're not really Buddhist as such. These are obvious universal characteristics of existence that you can believe in, whether you are a Buddhist or not, or whatever you are, because these are just basic realities of life. But remember the Buddhist idea of impermanence, right? Impermanence means that nothing in the world is really stable. Nothing in the world is the same, you know, even 2 moments, let alone over long periods of time. Things are always changing. Things are always moving from one state to another one. Nothing is ever there. Nothing can ever be relied upon, right? That is quite scary, isn't it? Nothing can be relied upon. Well, maybe not quite nothing. You can rely upon the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, from my point of view anyway, if you're a Buddhist, and I can kind of carry on and carry on through life. But essentially, even that is uncertain, because even the Buddha's teaching will one day disappear, right? It will be gone. And you can't even rely on that ultimately either, because that too is going to disappear. And one of those sayings that the Buddha has in the suttas is that everything that is dear and agreeable to you must become otherwise, must change. Everything that is dear and agreeable to you must become otherwise, must change. And the Buddha says that this is something that everybody should reflect upon. Whether you are a woman or a man, whether you are a householder or somebody who's gone forth into monastic life, everybody should reflect on that. Right? Why? Because it is a very powerful foundation for living your life in the wise way. If everything in life, dear and agreeable to you, must become otherwise, what does it mean? What it means is that you start to rely less on those things. You start to attach a little bit less to those things. You try to find other places where you can find your happiness and your sense of satisfaction in life, rather than all of those things that must become otherwise and must change. And if you start to look at it, it is very obvious that that is the case, right? The things that are most dear to us usually are our relationships, our families, the people who are very close to us. And again, you cannot, ultimately, you can't really rely on that. You don't know when you're going to end up divorced. You don't know if your partner is going to die. You don't know how long your family members are going to be around you to support you. All of these things are uncertain, right? I always try to think of myself, and I think, how long am I going to be around? I have absolutely no idea. I could walk out into the street after this talk and bang, be gone, right? You never see me again, right? Or whatever, where I could have a cancer in my body right now and 2 weeks' time I'll be finished. This is the problem with life, right? It is so many unreliable aspects to it. So just by taking on board very carefully, don't force yourself too hard. Don't kind of go back and, oh no, these Buddhist teachings are too hard, I can't deal with this, right? Or everything here and agreeable will become otherwise. Don't let yourself down and become depressed because of these things. Take them on board slowly and carefully, and then gradually the truth of these things will become clear to you. And as they gradually become clear to you, and this is why you have to hear Dhamma talks regularly, to remind you of these things, so it goes in more and more deeply over time. And then gradually as you do that, that law of impermanence, the law of changeability, becomes an aspect of who you are as a person, an aspect of your own psychology, and you start to become less vulnerable to the realities of life. It's not just our family, it's everything in the world, right? In recent times, we had all this kind of, many people are kind of shocked by the way the world is going. Oh, we don't know, the politics, everything seems so kind of up in the air these days, right? Well, some people are very happy with these changes, other people are not so happy. That's kind of what you can expect. But remember that if you are one of those people who suffered because the world seems so uncertain and seems so unreliable, remember, this is Buddhism 101, right? Impermanence, unreliable, uncertain. What do you expect? This is the politics of the world. One politician comes, another one comes in. Things are always changing. It has to be like that, right? And the more clear that is to you as you are starting out, the less shocked you become when these events finally kind of come into your life, right? And you can actually deal with them in a much more powerful way as a consequence. The Buddha talks about impermanence on all kinds of scales, from the impermanence of the entire universe, right? It's actually one of those amazing things when you think about it. I gave a talk a while ago about Buddhist cosmology, right? About how the Buddha sees the universe and how the Buddha sees all kinds of things. One of the astonishing things about reading some of the suttas is when the Buddha starts talking about other galaxies, basically, other solar systems, other life forms out in the universe. Right? And first of all, I'm going to really think, there must be, who knows how that got in there, right? There must be some kind of problem. Somebody wrote it in there later on. But that can't be the solution, because these things have been in these texts for centuries. Some of the paper that these texts are on is actually way before these things became common knowledge in humanity, right? And then you think, maybe it's just a matter of interpretation, right? We are interpreting these things, and we are reading things into these ancient texts, which isn't actually there. But actually, I happen to know the Pali language. I can read these things in the original. And the scope for interpretation actually is very limited. Right? And you are kind of, once you kind of weed out the possibilities, you're sort of almost forced to accept that the Buddha had certain insights into the nature of the universe that are absolutely astonishing. How could the Buddha have known these things? But really, as far as I can see, having studied these things, I cannot see how you can come to any other conclusion that the Buddha actually knew about these things. And he talks about the kind of the expansion and the contraction, or the evolution and devolution of the universe, right? Over vast cycles of time. And it sounds like, whether you like it or not, it sounds like he's talking about big bangs, big crunches and that sort of thing. It's kind of mind-boggling when you think about that. How could this man in India, right? We see him on the walls around here, sitting under a tree. How could he have known about these things? It's kind of absolutely mind-boggling. I'm not going to get into that. And my point is, the reason why the Buddha talks about these things is not to prove that he has some kind of supernormal ability to see the universe. No, the reason why he talks about these things is to show us the impermanence on a grand scale. To show us how the earth, he actually specifically says in one sutta, in the future, the earth is going to burn up because of the heat from the sun. How the Buddha could know that is, again, absolutely mind-boggling, but it says that in there. And the reason why it says that is to show us the impermanence of all phenomena, how nothing is ever stable, how eventually everything will crumble and turn to dust, everything will kind of fade away and become otherwise. And that is when you seek somewhere else. You seek somewhere else for your refuge. Your refuge is kindness. Your refuge is compassion. Your refuge is understanding of other people, looking at other people in the right way, right? So just that much, just the understanding of the impermanence of all phenomena, how nothing is stable, everything ultimately is out of control, right? Just that understanding is also helps you a lot to have some sort of emotional resilience. Why? Because you start to go with the flow. You understand the limits of the world. You don't take it so seriously anymore. You don't grasp onto it in the same with the same force as it used to earlier on. Yeah? Okay, so two things let's talk about. One thing, the power of having a place to go, a refuge in life. Second thing, to remind yourself of the impermanence of all phenomena so you don't become so confused and concerned when things actually go opposite of what you were hoping they would go. The last thing I'm going to talk about is just a little bit about how to regulate your emotions, right? To avoid getting too upset and angry when things go wrong in a more practical way, right? One of the most difficult things in life are other people, right? Is that right? Other people? Very difficult, right? Oh, they are so upsetting and so can be so hard to deal with other people. Is that true for principles as well? Or is it true for everyone? It's true for everyone. Other people is the most difficult thing. So one of the very useful things to know about from a Buddhist point of view is how do we deal with other people? How can we learn to deal with people in such a way that we, instead of getting upset and angry, that we have a sense of compassion, loving kindness, metta, or at the very least, neutrality, right? Sometimes it's very hard to have metta. Certain people, oh, you wish you could have metta for them, but it's so hard. So at least neutrality, right? And then that neutrality is already quite good. So how can we do that in life? And the Buddha, well, this is actually Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's right-hand man, he gives us beautiful teaching about how to overcome resentment and anger in life, and refers to other people. And what he says in this particular sutta, he says that when you find that you're having a problem with somebody in life, right? When somebody upsets you or they causes problems for you, what you should do at that time, when you see those negative qualities in them, you should focus away from those negative qualities and you should see the positive qualities instead. Right? If you look at average, ordinary human beings, they're often very complex. They have so many different sides. And yes, they have some negative sides, but yes, they also have positive sides. Right? One of the wonderful things about being a Buddhist monk, and this is reason enough to become a Buddhist monk, right? So if you find this compelling, you can come to me afterwards and let me know if you are ready for the monastic life. But this is a reason I have to become a Buddhist monk, and that is that you meet so many good people in the world. Wherever I travel, wherever I go, and I actually travel quite a lot, right? I don't just come to Sydney once a year or whatever it is. But everywhere, you meet so much good people everywhere. You meet people who have so much kindness, good intentions, and you actually realize that there is a lot of goodness in this world. If you look on the news on television, you might think the world is a terrible place. But remember that what you see on television is a digest of the worst stuff happening among 7 billion people, all digested into half an hour, right? Of course it's going to be pretty bad if you take, if you kind of extract all the worst aspects of humanity and you whack it together in half an hour, it's going to be pretty bad news, right? That's why news are such bad news. But if you actually look at people in their daily life, what they actually are like, you actually find a lot of kindness and compassion and understanding in the world, right? How people treat them on a day-to-day basis. How Buddhist people often act toward each other. Certainly how they act towards me, right? They're very kind, which is wonderful. And when you see that, it gives you another slant, another viewpoint on humanity. And it gives you a sense of hope that actually there is a lot of goodness in the world. And if you want to practice metta meditation, if you want to practice kindness in your life and all these kind of things, it's so important to remember that goodness is actually there. Because that is the foundation for metta. That is the foundation for loving kindness, seeing the goodness in other people. So remember that when you come here to this Buddhist school. If I assume that at least the teachers here are probably practicing according to Buddhist principles, right? Many of you here are long-term Buddhists. I know some of you by faith, not so far from everybody. And when you know that somebody is a Buddhist, they're practicing the five precepts, they are coming to the Poya days or the Uposatha days, right? Today, by the way, is the full moon. So today is like one of the Uposatha days. It's a traditional day when we give Dhamma talks and that sort of thing. When you know that somebody is practicing these things, at the very least, they have intentions that are good, right? Trying to do the right thing in the world. You should say, hooray! What a wonderful this thing is that people actually are trying, right? They may not be perfect. They may not always succeed. What a remarkable thing in the world, which is so complex and so difficult. And where there are so many things that actually go against us all the time. Still, people are able to at least intend on moving in the right way. At least they have the right intentions. They want to make life better for themselves and also for the people around them. Wow, hooray! I'm so glad to have you as a friend, right? You're kind of uplifting to see all these good qualities inside of you. So this is what we do. Don't look at that silly little mistake they made. Right? Everybody makes mistakes. That is not important. What is important is the big view, the overall idea of how these people are living their life. That is what really matters. And the Buddha has a beautiful simile for this, to show how this actually works. He says it is like a rag-robed bhikkhu. Okay, this is a bhikkhu, right? This one here? This is a bhikkhu, this weird kind of, these kind of weird clothes. And rag robes, these are the robes, right? So you can imagine a rag robe basically means that you get all these rags and you sew them all together and you put them together and you get a rag robe. I used to have one of those when I was a young monk, about 15, 16 years ago, whatever. I had a rag robe. It looked very colorful, right? Looking really, really, actually quite nice because it really looks really worthless. So you have a rag robe, or you are a rag robe wearing bhikkhu, maybe a rag robe wearing bhikkhuni. Maybe a rag robe wearing a preceptor. Have you seen any rag robe wearing a preceptor? No? And when you are wearing rag robes, they always have to be patched because they're always falling apart. So you're always looking for rags, right? So this rag robe, the simile is like the rag robe wearing bhikkhu. He's coming and he sees a rag by the roadside. When he sees a rag by the roadside, he spreads out the rag. Right, so we get some overview of this rag, the good parts and the bad parts. Right, then after he has spread out the rag, he tears off those parts that are no good. What does he do with those parts that are no good? He chucks them out, right? Why? Because it's rubbish. And then he takes the good part and he carries that with him in his little bag or in his little pocket or whatever it is. He carries that with him into the future so he can use it whenever it is required. In exactly the same way, we spread the person out in front of us, the good qualities, the bad qualities. We see the whole gamut of qualities, right? Then we take the bad qualities from over here, we tear off the bad qualities, and we chuck it out. Why? Because it's rubbish. It's not worth focusing on those bad qualities. They are unfortunate side effects of what it means to be human sometimes. But it's not something that we should carry with us in our heart. And then we take those good qualities, right? And we take them, fold them nicely together, and then take them in, and take them into our heart, and carry them with us into the future. So when they are required, we can take them out and remind ourselves of the good qualities of this person. So it's almost like what we're doing is that we are creating a shelf of perceptions. This shelf of perceptions are the good qualities of a person. They are the shelf of the thing I was talking about before, the perception of impermanence, right? And on that shelf, we have various types of perceptions that are useful to make our life work out properly. And then when a negative thought comes up, we go to that shelf, we pull down that perception, and it counteracts the negativity inside of us. Right? It's a very powerful and very simple technique to use. It's something everyone can do. The hard part is to just keep on doing it long enough, time and time again, so that you actually learn how the process works. But actually, it is very simple. Always remind yourself of the good qualities in other people. And when you do that, you will cool down, right? You won't get so hot so easily. And you feel that you are more even in life, walking through life in an even manner. There's a second simile that the Buddha uses for exactly the same thing. And this simile is of a man who is weary and thirsty and hot, right? And because he's weary, thirsty, hot, is a metaphor for anger here, right? If you're angry, you feel hot inside, and you feel tired, you feel weary, because anger tends to sap our energy, and we have no energy anymore afterwards. So this man comes, or maybe a woman, keep it gender neutral, so comes along, right, weary, thirsty, and parched, comes to a pond, right? Now, when this person comes to the pond, what they do is first thing they do is to take away all the algae and water plants, push them to one side, and after they have pushed aside all the algae and water plants, they go into the pond, and they bathe in the pond, and they drink in that beautiful, clean water in that pond. Right? And similarly here again, the person who is thirsty, weary, and parched is the angry person. When you're angry, you come to the pond is like another person. The first thing you do, push aside the algae and the water plants. That's like the bad qualities. Get rid of those bad qualities, right? They're not going to do you any good. And underneath those bad qualities, you see all the beautiful, cooling qualities of that person, right? And when you see all those beautiful, cooling qualities of the person, you drink it aboard. You drink it in, you take it inside of yourself. And when you drink those good qualities aboard, you cool down, the anger disappears, and you feel even. You even have a sense of metta for this person as a consequence. Oh, it's hard to give a talk when the paparazzi comes out. No, that's fine, please. It's a test for me. It's impermanence. So that is the idea here. Mr. Powell, please tell me if I talk too much, because sometimes it kind of goes too far. So I will stop when I'm ordered to, or I will stop after an hour, whatever comes first. There's one more thing, right? And that is sometimes you find people who are not, you can't find any good qualities in them. You look at them, you stretch them out this way and that way, all you see is bad qualities. Have you ever met people like that before? So the question is then, is it, sometimes it's just your perception, right? They may actually have good qualities, but you are so blinded by your own kind of negativity that you can't see the good qualities in there. But it doesn't really matter what it is. It doesn't matter whether they really have good qualities or not. What matters is that you are not able to see those good qualities. And because you are unable to do so, the question is, what do you do then? What if you can't see any good qualities? What then is the answer to this idea of using your perceptions in a new way, right? And the answer is that in this case, if you can't see anything good in that person, that is the time to have compassion, right? Why? Because a person who has no good qualities, they are creating an enormous amount of bad karma for themselves. They are moving towards their own destruction, so to speak, towards their own suffering in the future. And if somebody is so deluded and so out of it that all they are doing is creating suffering for themselves, then the right answer is to have compassion, right? Nobody really wants to create suffering for themselves. But if they are so blind that they can't see what they're doing, then they are worthy of compassion. And the Buddha, or this Venerable Sariputta, said it's just like if somebody is sick, somebody is gravely ill, right? And they are, in this case, the simile is of a man again, walking in the wilderness. There is no villages around. There's no people to give him medicines. But he is gravely sick. No medicines, no doctor, no food, no water, nobody to look after him, right? How do you feel when you see a person like that? When you see a person who is sick for no fault of their own, right? And you see them kind of staggering along, trying to find a way out of this. There's nobody there to help them. How do you feel? You feel compassion, right? And if you have a chance to help that person, that is exactly what you will do, because it's like your heart tends to open up to people like that. People who are suffering for no fault of their own, your heart opens up and you want to help them and you want to do something for them. And it's exactly the same with somebody who has all bad qualities. You start to realize they may be abusing me, right? They may be giving me a hard time, but actually they are creating far more problems for themselves, right? They are moving down a path towards calamity and disaster. This is the literal translation by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, calamity and disaster. It's quite, I like that translation because calamity really kind of drives home the point. Moving towards calamity and disaster in their own life, right? They are moving in darkness, moving in delusion, not really understanding what they're doing, creating enormous suffering for themselves. Yes, they may be creating some suffering for you, for me, right? But actually the suffering they're creating for themselves is far, far, far worse. And what happens there, something very beautiful happens. Because we tend to be so focused on ourselves, which is natural, there's nothing wrong with being focused on ourselves. But we tend to always feel the pain that other people give us. But what happens here, when we focus on the other person instead, and we see that they are actually creating far more suffering for ourselves, our view of things changes 180 degrees around. And instead of looking at ourselves, we're looking at the other person instead. And then compassion can arise. Instead of feeling, poor me, you're feeling, wow, I have so much compassion for you because you have no idea what you're doing, no idea how you're living your life. Right? And it's so nice when we give up that kind of self-concern. Self-concern is so limiting. It narrows down your mind, right? It's my little world here against all the other people. When you get rid of that self-concern and you think about other people instead and you understand compassion on a larger scale, it opens up your mind, opens up your heart, you get a connection with others in a very different way. And these ideas of boundless metta and these things become possible from that point of view. So that is the beautiful way of remembering this, of being able to deal with people who are very difficult in our lives, right? Even the most difficult ones, it's possible to have compassion and kindness towards them when we think about them in the right way. It's all about attitude. It's all about understanding, thinking about things in the right way. Everything changes completely. So these are some little bit of advice from the suttas, how to deal with these things. And I got a few minutes more, so I'm just going to keep on talking, right? At least for another 5 minutes. And one of the reasons why this last, very last perception I'm talking about now, why it is so powerful, and this is kind of at the back here, and a very important part of this to really understand, to get the full benefit of this particular contemplation, and that is the Buddhist teachings of non-self. Right? Anatta, one of the most profound and most important of all the teachings of the Buddha, is something that you really have to discover through meditation ultimately, but we can also use it in lesser contexts to understand how to live our life in a good way. And one of the consequences of the teaching of non-self, or anatta, is that we are not selves, we are not entities that move around the world, right, as stable entities, like kind of how our own inner life completely unaffected by circumstances around us. No, it is the exact opposite of that. We are, in fact, instead of being entities moving around in the world, what we are the sum of the causes and conditions and the circumstances that work on us. That's what we are, right? If you look at your personality now, who you are in terms of your act, in terms of how you think, in terms of how you look at the world, that personality is the sum total of all the causes and conditions that have worked on you in this life and also probably in previous lives. That is who we are. Right? And I always like to use the simile of a ship on the ocean. But if you have a ship on the ocean, a ship which has no steering mechanism, no rudder, no engine, no sails, no oars, all you have is the hull of the ship, right? What happens to that ship? What happens to that ship is that it is completely at the mercy of the prevailing conditions, right? The wind comes from the north, the ship goes to the south. The wind comes from the east, the ship goes to the west. The current comes from the west, the ship goes to the east. It's all the prevailing conditions on that ocean that decide whether the ship is going this way or that way, whether it's going in the right direction or the wrong direction, right? And we are just like that. We're like ships on the ocean. We are the function of the circumstances always working on us. That is a consequence of the idea of anatta, of non-self. Right? So if you have been influenced in the wrong way, you're going to do crazy things. You're going to be a pain in the neck for everyone around you, right? Because your conditioning is so bad. So remember that when that person is doing something towards you which is not nice, they're telling you off, saying something not nice, even doing unkind things. Why are they doing that? It's not personal. Got nothing to do with you, right? It's not because you are, somehow their favorite bully object or whatever. Nothing to do with that, right? The reason why it is happening is because of their internal conditioning and external conditioning. They have come to this point now in space-time. You happen to be at the wrong place and at the wrong time. And for that reason, you have to bear the brunt of how this person is acting towards you. So remember that, right? This person is trapped by cause and conditions, trapped by their own personality that has been developed like this over a long period of time. They can't help themselves. This person probably knows that they should be kind. They know that they should be doing the right thing. But the forces inside of this person are so strong, they cannot help but to do what is bad and what is wrong. So then, when you look at it in that way, things start to change. Things start to kind of gel. You think, yeah, if that is true, they really deserve compassion. Nothing to do with me. No reason for me to get upset. This has to do with them only. And then compassion can start to arise inside of you. Sometimes using these powerful and deep teachings of the Buddha can help you even with these kind of more ordinary things. Learning how to find a stable mind, right? A mind which goes through life in a stable fashion without actually being so caught up in the ups and downs of the world. And then you find your life becomes so much easier, so much more beautiful. And you are able to help not only yourself, but also to help other people around you. So, I'm just going to summarize very briefly what I've said, because I've already talked for 1 hour. It's amazing how quickly 1 hour goes. I can never believe how short. If 1 hour is that short, it means life is pretty darn short as well. So, three things, right? Remember the wonderful thing of having a place in life where you can go, that can be your refuge, where you can find a sense of wisdom and a sense of understanding. What a great blessing it is. If you are a Buddhist and you have the Buddhist teachings at that refuge, it's a very powerful help in stabilizing your emotions and making you emotionally more resilient. Remember the impermanence of everything, right? Nothing is ever stable. Nothing is ever going to be the way you think it's going to be. If the world goes down the drain, right? Okay, so the world goes down the drain. Well, what do you expect? That's what happens to the world sometimes, right? Sometimes it goes down. You know what I mean? Can we deal with that? Well, if you can't do anything to help, you do your best to help out. And if nothing you can do about it, you've got to shrug your shoulders, right? And say, okay, that's what's happening here. It sounds perhaps a bit callous. It sounds a bit hard-hearted. But the reality is that sometimes it is like that. And then, if you're not going to suffer too much, you're just going to have to accept it, right? Remember impermanence. It's unreliable. It's uncertain. You just have no idea what's going to happen next. And last thing, remember how to deal with people in the right way. if at all possible, see the good qualities in other people. And when you see the good qualities, it's possible to have metta, it's possible to have loving kindness, and it's possible to deal with them in a good way. If that isn't possible, at the very least, have compassion with those people who are really difficult in the world, because they need as much compassion as they can possibly get. And then perhaps there is some hope for them as well. Okay, so there you are. It's a little bit about emotional resilience. So now, if you like, we can maybe ask some questions if you want to. You're more than welcome to ask some questions. And remember, the Buddha said the thing that if you want to be intelligent in the future life, you've got to ask questions in this life, right? Okay. Any questions, anyone? Any comments? Any complaints? Yes.
Principal always have
to okay,
just a question on the anicca, everything is impermanent.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with what you say in terms of that. Yes, the world sometimes comes to a bad end, but how do we, we have to remind Buddhists, this is a point I mentioned earlier, that yeah, sometimes we just take it as it is.
Yeah.
All you said is correct. And of course, there's more that you understand than I haven't understand. But what my challenge personally, when I try to teach people to take that change, is also to find ways to help them put optimism in, put the effort into to get out.
Sure. Well, the optimism comes because you know that when you live your life well, it will have good results for you, right? I mean, where the world goes and what is good results for you are often two very different things. You can be joyous in the world that goes down the drain, right? If you don't rely on the world to give you that kind of sense of happiness, you can have joy in that. So if you live your life well, it doesn't matter so much anymore where the world goes, right? Your own life is kind of satisfied. Your own life is heading in the right direction. You get your joy from just being kind, from helping people to the best of your ability. And that is kind of the beautiful thing about remembering impermanence. You know where to put in your energy in life, what actually matters, and you put your energy there. Now, we were talking about before, it's not when you are young, you think, oh, what should I do, right? Should I kind of, what kind of career should I have? Should I be a policeman or a fireman, that kind of thing, right? Or a stockbroker or a doctor or whatever it is that people want to be these days. But actually, all that is kind of irrelevant. It doesn't matter. You can be anything. What matters is the quality of heart you bring to that job. It's how you live rather than what you live that matters. How do you do that job rather than what you do? That is what is important. And if you focus on the how, the rest will fall into place regardless of things. But there is another point with that which I think is also very important, and that is that sometimes people say, well, if we just accept everything for what it is, then should we do something in the world to help out, right? And yes, we should, definitely, because helping out in the world is a source of good karma, is a source of actually feeling happy about things. So we have to find that balance whereby we help as much as we can, but we understand the limits of our helping. We can only help so far. Beyond that, there's nothing we can do. And beyond that, that's what we have to accept. That can be fine, very fine balance, right? We have to kind of negotiate that back and forth a little bit. We do what we can in the world, but there comes a point when we just have to accept things. Death is a classic one. Not much choice, right? We're going to have to accept death. And so the sooner we kind of get to that point where we accept these things, the easier our life is going to be. So, happy with that?
It's just a point that amongst Buddhism, it sounds a bit fatalistic in that we accept things, But I hear what you're saying, and because you did answer in the look at the positive of people and find metta, so with metta and compassion, that's the motivation to bring you out to do good to others. So it's just a question, one that the middle ones makes Buddhists feel a bit fatalistically I can't do much because I'm happy now, and that's the point that I'm okay. But I think you're seeing goodness.
Sure. We have to be very. I think we have to be very careful because Buddha is not really fatalistic at all. It's just that sometimes the forces around us are so strong we can't do anything about them. That's really what it means. By doing our best in the world, that's how we create our own happiness anyway, right? By being kind and being good and trying to lift everyone up and doing something positive. So, I think it's an important point that sometimes we go too far down the road of say, accept, everything's, this is the way it is. we should be careful about that as well. That's, I think that's a very important point. But, yeah. Yes.
I think, John, you know, a school like this is a good opportunity to develop spiritual friendship, similar moral precepts.
Yeah.
In what way have you benefited from spiritual friendship? And can you translate that into like a school environment?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Envision going back to school and maybe how it would.
Well, that's a long time ago. Yeah. Okay. It's gonna be hard. I can envision. Yeah. That's great. Are you a student here? Or are you?
No. I just found out about school today.
Oh, really? Okay. That's pretty cool. Oh, thank you very much. Very kind of you. So that's good combo. See, that's very nice of you to do that. I read the result. That's even better for me. So. Yeah, no, I think that's right, and I think that is as a monk, is one of the, I think, most important things about living the monastic life, is that actually the monastic life gives that spiritual friendship. My teacher in Perth is Ajahn Brahm. I've heard about Ajahn Brahm, right? The guy who tells all the jokes, right? All the stories of Ajahn Brahm. So maybe one day he can come here and tell some of his stories. And he is one of these people, and I have lived with him for 22 years, and my respect for him just grows all the time after 22 years. Usually after 22 years, kind of the familiarity causes contempt, kind of starts to set in, right? It hasn't set in yet, right? After 22 years. And that is a very, very strong sign that there's something very, very good going on there. So that is one of the most important things with spiritual friendship, is to have somebody like that who kind of lifts everybody up, right? And we all have that. I mean, you may not think of any individual person right here in this school, but as those go, but the Buddha is always there. The suttas are always available to us, right? So that spiritual friendship is always possible there, at the very least in the suttas. But in monastic life, you have someone like Ajahn Brahm, you have other people who are practicing in the same way as you are, so everybody lifts everybody up, everybody kind of moving in the same way. And this is one of those wonderful things, I think, too, in a Buddhist school. If you try to live according to spiritual ideas, whether you keep the five precepts or not is perhaps not so important. But it's a wonderful thing to be able to reflect on. Your fellow students, right, your fellow pupils, actually are probably good people, right? Otherwise, why would they be in a Buddhist school? They're trying to kind of do something positive in life. And you can all become Kalyanamittas, spiritual friends for each other. That can become a very beautiful thing in a school like this. And it's very fortunate to have a committed Buddhist like Mr. Pal to be your principal, right? It's great to have that. So he, in many ways, he is like kind of the cheerleader or the leader of the team, right? Pulling everybody forward in the right direction. What a wonderful thing that is to have a principal like that. And so you are, in many ways, like a team, just like a monastery. I don't always agree with Ajahn Brahm, even though I respect him enormously. Sometimes I think why is he saying these stupid things? And you sometimes may think all these stupid jokes, right? But sometimes you may think the same thing about your principal. Sometimes you may not agree, right? But the overall picture, again, is beautiful. The overall picture is so good. Here is someone who is dedicated to doing what is right in the world. What a wonderful thing that is, right? To have a principle like that. To have somebody who is basing the whole education philosophy on positive values and positive ideas. Right? Sometimes you wonder what is really important in life. And people say, you have to have the best teachers, it has to be really high quality education, that kind of stuff. But if you learn something even more profound, something that is some values that you can take with you throughout life, aren't these things in the end even more important than the actual education you have? If you come out of this school as a better person than when you started, isn't that even more important in many ways? Because those qualities that you come out with, then you can use to actually probably enhance your education, right? Because these basic fundamental values that we have, these are the things that carry us through everything in life. Carry us through our ability to study properly, carry us through our ability to work properly, carry us through our ability to function in a family relationship properly, right? So it's wonderful to have, and I think you're very right about the idea of Kalyanamitta. Kalyanamitta is, the Buddha said, 100% of the spiritual life, right? It's everything. Without Kalyanamitta, there is nothing there. So to be good Kalyanamittas to each other, just like monks are in the monastery, is a wonderful thing. It's probably one of the things that you get for almost for free, right, by going to a Buddhist school. Are you good Kalyanamittas? You're one of the students, right? Are you good Kalyanamittas to each other? Good kind of spiritual friends? Not always, sometimes, yeah. Okay, well, we got something to work on, right? Work in that direction.
Yes.
Anyway, so I'm not sure that exactly was your, but again, you know, if you go back to the idea of anatta and non-self, that is where you start to understand the importance of kalanamitta. Because if you are like this hull, this ship on the ocean, going according to the currents or whatever, you need to get the current from the right side. You need to get the wind from the right side. When the wind comes from the right side, you will go in the right direction. And the same thing in human life. If we get the teachings, the right wisdom, then that will drive us in the right direction almost automatically. And that is why kalyanamitta, spiritual friendship, is so important. In fact, the Buddha says it is 100% of the spiritual life. And now you can see why that actually must be the case. Anything else? Everybody happy here? Oh, everybody's so happy here. this is the first time I come here. You may never see me again, you know? This is your chance to ask to ask questions.
I have lots of questions, yeah. But I, you know, I don't want to be the only one asking.
Yeah, please not be shy about asking questions. Yeah, sure you can.
So I've heard, this is a fact that I know, that many sports teams, like NBA basketball, are getting mindfulness coaches.
Oh, right, yeah.
So it's not too difficult to understand that mindfulness would help with hitting a ball or something
like that.
Of course, So it's got that worldly benefit for kids in school that want to shoot some hoops. Could you offer a definition of mindfulness?
Definition of mindfulness? It's just basically it is just about awareness in the present moment, right? But ideally it is an awareness which is not biased by defilements, right? So it's like an awareness where you're kind of cool inside and you're looking at things in a fairly neutral way and you know what's going on. That's really what mindfulness is. One of the most important things with mindfulness is your ability to control yourself and to guide yourself in the right direction, because you are aware of what's happening in your mind, right? You can see that your mind is now moving in the wrong direction, you're becoming upset or whatever, you're getting some massive desire coming up. And before that happens, you can actually switch course and go in a different direction. Just like now, we're talking about this, you know, you get upset with somebody. And because you have the Buddhist teachings perhaps in the back of your mind, and you're starting to get upset, you remember this idea of the various qualities of people. You shift your mind onto the good qualities instead, just in time. But the only way you can do that is if you have enough mindfulness. So it is awareness, but it also is about awareness. Where exactly do we have awareness? You can have awareness about many things. You know, you can be like a stockbroker, and you can be aware of all the share prices going up and down, and buying, selling very quickly, or you can be awareness of the hoop, right? And you're going to the NBA or whatever. But from a Buddhist point of view, the most important awareness is an awareness of your mind, so you can control your emotions, and you can go through life in a more kind of even way. Yes.
So what would be the difference between mindfulness and concentration?
Okay, the difference is that mindfulness is a general awareness of things, right? You are aware, it can be a broad field, not narrowed down very much. Concentration, samadhi, is awareness of a very narrow object, right? So you can sit here and have mindfulness, and you can hear sound coming, right? Blah, blah, blah. You can be thinking coming, tiredness happening, restlessness, whatever, all of these things are happening, and you have a broad field of awareness. When you have samadhi, the field of awareness narrows down to one object. Let's say the mindfulness of reading, right? Or even if you're just reading a book, you're fully focused on reading the book. That is really the difference there. But remember that, from a Buddhist point of view, mindfulness is the cause and condition for samadhi to happen, for concentration to happen. Actually, I'm banned to say concentration. My teacher, Adam Ram, says concentration is a bad word. So if he hears me say concentration, he'd be very disappointed. So stillness is the word that he used instead. Stillness of the mind which doesn't move, right? Similar kind of idea. Sati, mindfulness, is required first. Only when you have sati can the mind move towards samadhi as a consequence. So first comes mindfulness, because mindfulness is the ability to be in the present moment. That's also there when you have samadhi and stillness. And then once you have that general sati, then you can narrow it down onto to one thing at a time. So it's a gradual process, right? One thing after the other. One thing comes before the other one. Yeah. Happy? Make sense? Happy with that? No? Okay. Yeah.
No. Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, I'm just having every possible moment. So does that mean, like, in order to have the right concentration, the right mindfulness need to be that work?
Yes, exactly. Mindfulness is the cause and condition for right samadhi to happen on the Buddhist path. Then. First, because the mindfulness is basically what enables you to overcome the defilements of the mind, right? You know the defilements are there, they're not there. Mindfulness is the meditation which drives the mind onto the object, like the breath or whatever in there. And from that, samadhi happens from that. It's just the Buddha, not me saying this, the Buddha saying this, right? Just to be absolutely clear, doesn't it? Yeah. Real authority, yeah.
Just another question then. You mentioned about non-self.
Yeah.
And also the Buddha talked about identity view.
Yeah.
How are they different, or are they different?
They are very closely related to each other. Yeah. So identity view is this, or if you like, personal identity view, whatever you want to call this, the idea that there's some aspect of you which is always there, right? The real me, the kind of the core, the essence of what it is to be a human being. Yeah? That is very closely related to the idea of atta, of a self. Just slightly different ways of basically using that terminology, really. Yeah? So the identity view is a view, right? Whereas atta is a more kind of general idea of the sense of self. So you can have a sense of self in a more subtle way. So you can give up the identity view and still have very subtle feelings of self after that. And this is kind of, we're talking about very profound things now, talking about the various stages to awakening. Identity view goes first, but you can still, because of the strong habits from the past, sometimes still you think in terms of a me and an I, and that is kind of still that utter view, if you like, underlying there, still being part of the problem. So
how do you know that you have overcome identity view as opposed to atta?
Well, you never really overcome atta, because atta is just the wrong view, right? There's no such thing, that's a thing there in the first place. But identity view, how you know you overcome that? You know it by having this extraordinary experience, right? It blows you out of this world pretty much, and you think, whoa, what happened? Everything looks upside down from now on. Like, nothing really looks the way it was before anymore. What's going on? What happened here? And these are incredibly profound things, right? You're talking about, first of all, your meditation has to be to a level of very deep samadhi. One of the things that we see in the suttas is a samadhi pachaya yata buddha nanadasana. It is from samadhi that we get seeing things according to reality. This is throughout the suttas of the Buddha. And seeing things according to reality is precisely giving up the sakkaya ditti. You know that already the bliss and the power that you experience through samadhi is incredibly strong already. On top of that, you have a massive insight, right? That is when maybe you are you have kind of got to that point, maybe not. So these are, you know, so if you kind of think back one event on your life in your life that was so powerful that it has left you with a positive trauma. Positive trauma, I like this expression, positive trauma, right? Because you did trauma is bad. This is positive trauma. You can't get it out of your mind. It's so powerful and so beautiful. If you have an experience like that, either it's very profound samadhi, or maybe if it's even more positive trauma, it is giving up sakkaya ditti, possibly. Yeah. Yes, I'll be back there. I think there is a lot of truth to that. I think that makes good sense to me, that we tend to kind of project onto others, you know, some of the things that we have inside ourselves. I would agree with that. So for that reason, I think it's very powerful if you are able to have metta for that other person, despite their good bad qualities. It means that you have more metta for yourself as well, right? Because this goes both ways. So it means that you can overcome maybe the aversion to your own bad qualities, or the aversion to some, you know, maybe you're suppressing that, don't really want to deal with it. So I think it has a very beautiful knock-on effect towards yourself as well. Sometimes we talk about having metta for ourselves, but I think the metta for ourselves happens almost automatically if we just have metta for all other beings, or metta for the whole world, because we are included in that world, right? we're part of that as well. And by looking at other in a good light, we cannot really help but feeling good about ourselves as well there. And I think this focus on me, myself, I think it is too, to me, it's not, it's too, I mean, if it works for you or for someone, great, please do it. But to me, it has a kind of slightly weird kind of feeling about it, to focus on myself, you know, it doesn't feel quite right. I know that some people say that if you read the Visuddhimagga, it talks about, you know, having metta for yourself and all these kind of things. And it's interesting, it's based on a particular passage in the Pali Suttas, which seems to say that you should have, you should focus on yourself. But there have been some interesting studies on that, which show that that may actually be a wrong reading in the Pali Suttas. Actually, that should be read in a different way. I have some of my best friends in Buddhism. They are really, not only are they good meditators, but they're really good scholars as well. And they kind of, they do all kind of studies of the suttas in you know, all kind of different languages, in ancient Chinese, compared with the Pali, with the Sanskrit and Tibetan, right? Some of these people are amazing. I don't know how you can know so many ancient languages, but they seem to be able to do that. And sometimes you get some very interesting results when you do that kind of comparative study and you look at the same thing from many different angles. So, very interesting. Yeah.
What was the way that we're supposed to be looking at as opposed to looking at the self?
I think what you do is that you just have the first thing is to overcome any enmity that you have towards anyone out there. That's the first thing. Yeah. As long as you have some degree of enmity or ill will in your heart, it's impossible to develop metta. So basically, as Buddhists, if you're going to practice the Buddhist path, you can't really afford to have ill will towards anyone. You have to have good will towards everybody. That's already a kind of a tall order for some, but it's very nice when you can start to do that. And once you have abandoned that, then you can start to move towards the metta instead. And remember, the basis for metta is the basis is always metta in action and metta in words first. That is always first. And from that, you can develop further into the metta in meditation, practice, and thought. So the way you do that is just have metta for others, or have metta for the whole world, without any boundaries, right? And then you kind of become included in that. You don't really have to think about yourself personally so much. Anyway, that's just my, I mean, these things can be looked upon in different ways, right? I'm not kind of, and sometimes different people have to work with these things in different ways, so there isn't often any fine absolute answer to these things. But yeah. Okay. Good. So anything else before we call it a day? Call it a day? Yeah.
One more question.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
How do I help more Buddhists? Yes. Brings more of their metta to help spread awareness about this Buddhist school as a seed.
Yeah.
Because you know, I look at the Catholic Christian community.
Yeah.
They're very skillful in passing compassion and metta.
Yeah.
So how would I be able to to encourage Buddhists to spread the awareness?
Yeah. Okay. To spread the awareness of the school,
of the school.
Okay, so how to spread the awareness of the school? This is all about marketing, right?
Buddhist 101 marketing.
Exactly. Yeah. Gee, you're gonna be asking the right person.
I spent 2 years, first 2 years opening, thinking, conflicting between spiritual and worldly.
Yeah.
And I'm getting better, but I haven't refined the understanding of Buddhism yet.
So. Okay. Yeah.
I'm coming to a refuge with the elder.
Yeah, okay. take the suttas, the Buddha has to say about it. That's the real path, you know. That's the way forward. Yeah. So how do you spread the word about the school? Well, to be honest, I don't know. I think you probably maybe you should have to go out and give talks in Buddhist venues. You know, go to the Buddhist library, go to the Metta Center, go to places and kind of spread the word that it's actually happening. Yeah. When people see you, and if you do your job in a good way, people will say, "Wow, this is really cool. This is really nice." Obviously, the most important thing I think is to be a good example. You know, if you live your life well and you live it in the right way, people see that. That will also inspire them. And then you get some alumni after a while, right? The alumni, the people graduate, and then they say, "Wow, that school is so great! You know, send your kids there." So and this is how they rank schools around the world. How many Nobel Prize winners have you got from the Buddhist school, right? And then they rank it up the thing. So, I personally think it's a wonderful thing, because I think that Buddhism and Buddhist values. I don't even have to call them Buddhist values. They are so useful. We can call them secular values. Many of them have nothing to do with religion whatsoever. That is just wonderful that, you know, we have these people are actually being taught these things at school. I think it's great. I think it's a wonderful thing. I think it will create a better world, basically, if we keep on doing these kind of things. So I guess, yeah, so, you know, you just have to, I don't know, have you got a website for school then?
Yes, we have.
Yeah, yeah. Does it say, you know?
It says all that, I think, but the challenge, of course, is more real in the real world. Where you,
have you got some good quotes from some spiritual leaders on there?
Just Bhante Jason coming aboard.
Get some good quotes from Ajahn Brahm, right? Ajahn Brahm says, this school is the best, right? Something like that.
So since you've lived with Ajahn Brahm 24 years, maybe you can help
him. You have to do that job yourself, right? I will tell Ajahn Brahm about the school. I said it's a really cool school there.
And we'd like to invite him.
Yeah, invite him. Get some nice quotes from him and put them on the website. You know? Because he's such a well-known in the Buddhist community, so it'd be great for you. Yeah. Okay. Very good. So, that's it? Yeah? Is that it? Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Okay. Great. Okay. I think I'm a bit kind of squeezed right now anyway. It's probably good to get the stuff there. So. Okay, wonderful. So very nice to meet you all. Should we? What do you normally do at the end? Do you have any particular things? Should we all bow to the Buddha together? Have a nice idea.
Oh, we can be led by the elder.
Yeah, led by the elder. Okay. By that, oh, already bowed. Yes.
Oh, we're talking about Buddha's elder, not Christian elder.
Christian elder. Okay. Okay. So that's only 10 years. Yeah. So let's just pay respect to the Buddha. If you wish to, you don't have to. If you don't want to. Personally, I think it's a very nice thing to do. It makes it nice to pay respect. Yes, at the back there. Yeah.
Can we dedicate our merit of what we already hear from you and then dedicate to our...
Yeah, sure, we can do that. Yeah. So I'll just chant the traditional Sri Lankan way of dedicating merit. We'll do that together, and then we'll do the bowing afterwards.
Sorry. Before we go, Ajahn, I'd like to thank you on behalf of the school community.
Yeah.
For bringing yourself here and bringing, of course, a lot of merit to the school in many ways that you don't know, because you've educated the principal, which is the main teacher here, in many ways today.
Yeah.
So thank you very much in terms of making the time in a very tight schedule that you have, because the little you told me that you have been fully booked on your trip here to Sydney, and you made the impromptu agreement to come and have a talk at our school.
Yeah.
So that is a true Buddhist values that I've been, you know, aspiring to find in many monastics.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I've met you, and I've heard you. I heard about you only a week ago.
Yeah.
Okay,
there you are.
Thank you
very
much.
Good. Okay. Yeah.
We have a question.
Yes. Oh, yeah. One of the students. Okay, please go for it. Yeah.
What things do you do in your life?
What things I do in my life? I come to Buddhist schools and give talks. Right? I do in my life. If I don't do, and what I do, okay, number one priority in my life is to try to be kind to other people, right? That's my number one priority. When I read the word of the Buddha, I realize that what the basis for all kind of happiness in life, all meditation practice, everything else, is your ability to be consistently kind to others and also to yourself. So try to say kind things. I try to say, well, I'm just about to say something nasty. Shut up, right? What can I say instead? That's the kind of the way I try to think about my life. How can I think about other people in a nicer way, right? And moment to moment, try to be kind, try to avoid doing the bad things. That is kind of my main practice. And then I meditate, right? This is just as important, but you have to have the foundation first of all. Then I do the meditation practice on top of that. So most of the time I just hang out, I have a little hut in the forest. That's where I stay all the time, pretty much. I stay in this hut. Except when I come to Buddhist schools in Sydney. Then I don't hang out in my hut. It's a nice combination. I have a chance to help other people, to give talks. I travel actually quite a lot around many places in the world. And then I also have a lot of solitude in that monastery in Perth. Sounds good? You want to become a monk? Is your mother going to allow you to? Are you family?
Oh, no.
Okay. Okay, so let's do the sharing of merit together. Yeah. Idang me nyati nang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Idang me nyati nang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Idang me nyati nang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Let's pay respect to the Buddha. So, Lalita, go to the airport now, is that right?
Yeah.